This is No Direction's PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage. PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage was made possible thanks to the support of the Roll for Combat podcast, as well as the dedication of our team of volunteers. Due to possibly questionable language, this panel is rated Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
We got secrets.
Do it now!
Now we got stage fright.
I just finished a really big frap.
Big frap, that's your new name. How's it going, big frap? Oh, no, that's terrible. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Secrets of Galarian seminar.
Shh.
This is the
you
easiest
gave it
one
away.
For us to do.
Tell them.
Yeah, that's
because this is the one where you basically ask us to tell you secrets of Galarian, and we decide if we want to reveal them, and we usually will.
Well.
We're not going to
tell you
about
what they
Aridin.
Are. Yeah.
That's the standard. We aren't going to tell you about Aridin because that's not a secret.
You
that's,
can still ask.
I mean,
ask.
We'll tell you things that we've revealed around about Aridin, but we're not going to tell you the things we haven't.
I'm just going to preface by saying there are six established character in Pathfinder lore who are absolutely transgender, but we have not revealed yet.
Yes.
Fuck yes! Sorry.
Let's try to keep the cursing a little bit under control.
Yeah. This is being streamed live on Twitch. Hello,
and,
Twitch.
Yes, the internet does not abide
and
profanity.
We are supposed to be a family channel, so.
All right. So, let's start having questions. There and back.
So, I'm pretty new to Pathfinder, so this may be common knowledge or absurdly obscure, but in Rule of Fear, there's mention of, I think, Aldous Cantor's house burning down and this giant black egg being left behind that once a year, like at the end of the year at midnight, it shakes as if something's trying to get out.
That's pretty cool.
That is pretty awesome. Okay, so that's a great idea. We should put that in our campaign setting.
Yeah. If that had ever come up, what that was, or if they were really specific.
So that question was about a giant black egg in a burned down house in Ustalav that's mentioned in Rule of Fear, and whether or not we had any more information on that.
So the tricky thing there is that was written by Wes, who doesn't work at Paizo anymore. I've got him on text here. That's something that nobody. I'm not sure. I don't know. But it's in print. It could certainly be something if I hadn't. I don't know.
It's an olifant egg.
An olifant egg. Yeah, that makes sense.
Oh, by the way, I'm Mark Moreland.
Oh yeah.
We were gonna make them ask.
Those are secrets.
Those are secrets of. Yeah.
What's your middle name, Mark?
I'm not telling you.
What's your middle name, Mark?
I'm not telling you.
Oh.
I am the franchise manager at Paizo, so I work closely with our licensees to ensure that everywhere that Pathfinder or Starfinder appears, it is consistent with the Pathfinder and Starfinder material that we publish.
Yay, thank you for doing that. I'm James Jacobs. I'm the creative director for Pathfinder.
What's your middle name, James?
Alan.
It doesn't start with a J?
No, excuse me, Aristotle. I messed that up.
Damn it.
And?
Hi, I'm Crystal Frazier. I'm a developer at Paizo, and if you ask most of the people who harass me on Twitter, my job is largely to sit in mobile while people lecture me about Galarian canon.
That sounds like a relaxing, easy job. No. You look very nice today.
Okay, right, back questions. To questions.
Right here.
You said there's trans characters?
Sure.
Are there any like explicitly non-binary characters that you haven't been revealed that you can reveal to me? Because I am non-binary, so it is relevant to my
There's interest. Sort of one in the upcoming Sandpoint book.
Oh.
Yep. I don't want to reveal too much, but a character who is a female character in Rise of the Rune Lords is not necessarily so in the Sandpoint book coming up.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And let's go with the Minotaur Prince of Absalom.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Minotaur Prince / Princess.
Prince X.
Yeah. Oh,
there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's something we want to keep having representation as wide as possible, and it's really important to us, so.
Yeah,
thank you.
And if there's a character that we have not said either way, then they can be whatever you want them to be in your game.
Yeah. And we have a few that we've already said were non-binary.
Yeah.
I mean, we could always do with more.
Yes. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Reiko, right? The ninja?
Yes, the iconic ninja, Reiko, is agender.
Yep. And
not
then,
quite the same as...
The shifter is asexual.
Oh my goodness. Like nice.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. You check out her iconic, Meet the Iconic thing.
Yeah, and I think everybody in here probably knows about Chardra.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay.
She's perfect.
Yeah. All right. There in the back, otherwise I will not catch you because you're behind the pillar.
Yes. I've asked a lot of questions of various panels this PaizoCon, and this is the single most important question I'm going to ask.
Uh-oh. No pressure.
Of the three of you, which one of you is the Veiled Master? And if none of you are, who do you suspect?
Yes.
It.
That will explain a lot.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the question.
The question was, which one of you, Mark Morlands, is a Veiled Master?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the question.
Next question? Yeah, there, in the back.
In Book 5, Wrath of the Righteous, Herald of the Ivory Labyrinth, how badly did Iomedae mess up, and what are the consequences?
How did she mess up?
How badly did Iomedae mess up, and what are the consequences?
When she plucked mortals from the material plane.
Oh, she didn't.
What?
That was not... So when you... You're inferring, the question was, how badly did Iomedae mess up when she intervened in the affairs of mortals in Book 5 of Wrath of the Righteous, correct?
Yes.
Spoiler alert. So the role of the gods, one of the main reasons we've taken that stance on the deities is we want your player characters to be the ones who are solving situations and going on adventures and stuff. And if we start having high-level NPCs or even above them, gods coming in and solving the problems... There's no need for player characters, and we don't have a role-playing game. We have a novel line. And
we don't have a novel line.
Right, exactly, because we have a role-playing game. And so we generally don't want the gods to basically come in and solve problems. In that adventure path, Iomedae does not solve the problem for the player characters. And in a certain way of looking at it, she is a problem for the player characters, depending upon how the player characters act in that encounter. So... That type of situation where a god manifests on the plane, in your face like that, she isn't doing that to say, take a back seat, I'll take care of this whirlwind thing for you. She's basically telling the player characters, you got to step up and stop this thing from happening. If you do so, I'll help if I can, but you have to ask me, basically. And she's not going to give them everything that they need because... Then what's stopping Discari from stepping up and giving everyone else that they need and all of that? In Planar Adventures, this topic is covered a bit more in detail, and we have actual guidelines for like how if you as the GM want to give out like divine boons and rewards to the player characters.
Ooh,
thank you.
Yep. Yes.
Either explicitly or hint therein, where is the Whispering Tyrant's phylactery? However that word is said.
Blactory.
I can say it's not on the Isle of Terror.
Thanks.
We've got an adventure path.
Yeah, we have
about.
A whole adventure path that's going to detail
all that stuff.
More about the Whispering Tyrant than Galarian would prefer that we detail.
Yeah. So yeah, check out the Tyrant's Grasp adventure path.
Oh, I'm going
for sure. There.
Okay. Yeah, it's the Black Egg. There we go.
Going off of the Wrath of the Righteous, what's the deal with Nocticula?
What is the deal with Nocticula? So that whole thing is coming to a head in Return of the Rune Lords. And there's some hints in Planar Adventures. It talks about how her realm has been abandoned, and she's no longer there. So that's something that we're going to be covering in Return of the Rune Lords. So, since this is Secrets, and I guess I will spoil that one, she's going to become a chaotic neutral goddess of Midnight and Artists and Exiles. She's going to have a new look, and it's going to basically it's going to be a pretty new character. Right there?
Yes. in the history of the Five Kings Mountains, it talks about the five dwarven brothers who only had 9 years of peace and then had 700 years of war. What happened to the five brothers?
That's a good question.
Well, eventually they died. I mean, dwarves don't live 700 years. We haven't really said. That's one area of the world where we've given the basic broad brushstrokes, but haven't really delved deeply into a lot of that. So I don't think we've ever said.
They were arguing over Grandma's scalloped mushrooms recipe?
Yes, well.
Of course.
Yeah, no, I don't think we've. I don't think it's ever been nailed down what happened with the four brothers specifically in terms of their final fates.
Yeah, in some cases, it's going to be, we don't know. I mean,
yeah.
There, in the green shirt.
Me?
Yes.
What exactly happens to people that go into the Exalted Woods with Rasmirans?
That's a good question for Jason Bowman.
Yeah, the question was, what happens to the people who go into the Exalted Woods with the Rasmiran priests? They are saved by our God and Savior, Rasmir.
Rasmir ascends them to the next level of enlightenment.
Mm-hmm. Praise be Chad.
Yeah, praise be Chad. Chad Rasmir.
Chad Rasmir.
That's Rasmir's brother.
Yeah. So that's something that Rasmir and Rasmiran is one of Jason Bowman's big contributions to the campaign setting. And we've been kind of pushing him, Eric and myself and other people have been pushing him to get some more information about him. So hopefully that'll be coming soon. But I don't.
He's been really busy with this playtest thing for a while. So when we ask him, he's just like,
maybe that's what's happening. Nope, they're playtesting for us.
They're playtesting. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Roll like you believe.
In the front, the red shirt.
You mentioned earlier the Rune Lords. I was just curious, which would you say of the seven among them is the strongest?
The question was which among the seven Rune Lords is strongest?
What year?
We'll go with 4718.
Derek, the Rune Lord of Swole.
Get out.
In 47.
Do you even cast wrong?
At the start of 4718. It depends upon what time in the year 4718 you're asking. If it's at the start, I'd say Xanrigal. If it's the end, I'd say Sorshin.
How dare you?
Oh, I dare. They're in the middle of the back. Yes.
I know you said you're not going to say what happened to Aridin. I'm not asking about him directly, but Erasma has gotten a lot of grief about not revealing what was going to happen or even what's happened to him. And so my question is, can you comment on what she knows and what her motivations are in that regard?
She knows everything.
Yeah.
So
that question was not about Aridin directly, but about what about Aridin's ultimate fate and demise and death. Farazma knows, and what her motivations are for not saying anything.
Well, I mean, the gods are mysterious creatures, and we don't know what they're up to.
They don't have PR agents.
Yeah.
Although, if any of them did, it would probably be the one who has a bureaucracy of psychopomps.
Yeah, that's for sure.
I'm not saying the psychopomps don't regularly release press announcements.
Yes. Another thing to remember with Phrasma, she's not necessarily anyone's friend. She's not necessarily anyone's enemy. She's neutral. She's probably the most iconic, perfect neutral in the setting, because everything is born and everything dies, and that includes gods. So,
the Nosui are a little less perfect.
No sweater, especially when they get stepped on by giant lumbering inevitables.
She didn't get stepped on, she got punched.
It's the same thing, they have feet for hands.
What?
Well, maybe not. All right, next question. Right there in the green shirt.
Can you elaborate on the origin of the Eye of Abednego and what is in the dead center of the eye?
Ooh. Water.
The Eye of Abednego. Water. Swirling water.
Yeah.
When we were coming up with a map for Galarian, I think it was Eric, was like, I want it there to be a permanent cyclone hurricane thing on the map, because that's a neat thing to put on a map. And it makes the map of the setting look different than any other fantasy map.
Yeah.
Sure.
So that's basically the kind of maybe the behind the scenes mercenary answer to that. As to what is inside the Eye of Abednego, it formed during the start of the Age of Lost Omens when Aradin died and storms racked all of the world and everything like that.
And this one just didn't go away.
This one just didn't go away. And
it's like the one on Jupiter, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But that one apparently is going to go away within 20
years.
You
shut your mouth.
Yes. Unless the internet lied to me, which is entirely possible.
Unbelievable.
This is going to be like Pluto, where I lie to my children about science to preserve my own nostalgia.
As for what's in the Eye of the Bendigo, that's something that we might reveal someday. We haven't really... We've got some ideas of what it might be, but the purpose of that is not what's in it, but the fact that it's basically flooded all of the Sodden Lands, and it gives an interesting character to that region. They're way in the back. Yeah. Yep,
you.
Whenever somebody goes to Sarasan, they either don't return or they have no memory of it. Why?
I don't remember.
Where am I?
Yeah.
So with Sarasan, the question was, when people go to the continent of Sarasan, they either don't come back or they don't remember what was there. It's the short, again, the mercenary answer is we haven't gotten to it yet. We wanted to leave a corner of Galarian mysterious and somewhere for us to expand into. We didn't know who was going to be working on Galarian 10 years from now. In some cases,
still
it
don't
was
know
us.
Who's going
to
be.
But we want to leave some areas open for future exploration. One of the things that one of my philosophies is that every time I explain a mystery, I like to put at least one more mystery in its place so that there's always more stuff coming along. And we just haven't really done much with Sarasan yet. It's probably... When it was first envisioned, it was kind of a Australia analog with like the Dreamland and all of that stuff going on. But it could be anything.
Yeah, who knows what it'll look like when we finally put it in print. So
yeah, it's basically like a backdoor for us to, if we get a really great idea, like tomorrow or the next day. I guess I answered that question. Okay.
Is that why Galarian disappears in the Starfinder continuity?
We don't know.
You should ask the Starfinder creative director, who is not in this room.
Maybe another day.
They're in the back corner, then we'll see.
One of my favorite things that I like doing when reading the adventure path is trying to spot the Van Casterkin.
we had a fun Van Casterkin talk a few weeks ago.
So, what did their family do to warrant all the bad luck that seemed to fall on their family?
They're not good people.
Question is about the Van Casterkins and what they did to have all the bad luck that befell them, and I think they brought it on themselves.
Yeah.
They're not good people.
They don't have healthy coping mechanisms or communications.
Yeah, we've got a new Van Casterkin coming in the next in the first Rune Lords adventure. Her name is Lullaby, and she's kind of a jerk. She's kind of made some bad decisions.
She might be my favorite Van Casterkin,
too.
She's
pretty cool. She is pretty awesome. I think I agree. She's pretty cool.
Yeah,
she's definitely got the best outfit.
Yeah, a few weeks ago, or maybe a few months ago, whenever you were developing it, so it would have been a while ago, James and I and Adam Daigle sat down in James's office, and we drew out a whole family tree of who the Van Casterkins are and who's whose kid and who married whom. And
it's super complicated.
It's really complicated, and we realized that we had left ourselves some interesting directions to go with it.
Yeah, the problem is that we've said, what was it? We said Varric has several brothers.
Right.
No, we've said Saul has had several sons, but Varric only has one brother.
Correct.
And
we know that Saul has at least three kids because we've met...
I love designing tiny houses because I can work from anywhere. I am always on the move. This new PC lets me connect to the internet with LTE. And the battery life is phenomenal. I never have to stress about it.
Three of them.
Yeah. And so we had to start mapping out their family tree, and there's a lot of sideways in that tree.
There's a lot, yeah. There's a lot of so-and-so married so-and-so and then killed them, and their new wife was, you know, so-and-so, and she died, and yeah, it's not a family to marry into.
But part of the result of this is that when we finish up with Return of the Rune Lords, the Van Casterkin family line associated most directly with Saul will pretty much be wrapped up. but it opens up a new window into another era of Van Caskerkins going in the set. There will be second edition Van Caskerkins.
What rules changes will be reflected in the Van Caskerkin line?
Their background will just be that they're terrible people.
Yeah, they'll have there'll be a special background for them. It's like, Van Caskerkin, you have terrible luck because you make bad choices.
Your family sucks. Yeah. Minus two charisma.
Exactly. Let's go into the front. Yeah.
Kind of playing directly off that, which one of the Van Caskerkins is secretly Xanargo in disguise? And if not yet, which one of them will be post New Thasmon?
You think it's just one?
Yeah.
Yeah, how many of them?
Xanargo's tricky.
Yeah.
With the simulacrum spell.
Well, check out Return of the Rune Lords. That has Xanargo's and Van Caskerkins in the same six volumes. So. Yes.
Are there Van Caskerkins down in Orv? And, like, what else is down there that we haven't yet seen?
Wow, people love the Van Caskerkins. Why do you like the Van Caskerkins?
They're
terrible
people. They're terrible.
There are so many good people on Galarian who deserve your respect.
Van Caskerkins are, they're in there as people for you to, like, for the love of God, don't make this choice.
They're the
extra
special.
There's probably at least one
of them
down in Orv.
Probably. When we do an AP set in Orv, then we'll put a Van Caskerkin in there, maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
He, she, it will have made terrible choices.
Like going to Orv.
Yeah, that's a good one.
So, like, what exactly is down there that we haven't seen? Anything fun, spicy?
Nobody's seen
so
it.
Spicy?
Yeah.
Most that we've done with Orv is really in Into the Darklands, and there's an Orv under every continent, so... We haven't done much at all with orbs under, Kazmaran or Arcadia or Saracen, for example. But there's a...
Or even Tien Sha.
Yeah,
we've said
Tien
a little
Sha.
Bit, but...
It's very small amounts.
Yeah.
I've been wanting to set an adventure in the Midnight Mountains for a long time, just exploring that whole area that has, like, moose spores for moons floating up in the skies above. And so there's a lot of crazy, weird stuff going on in there I haven't really put much more thought into it yet, but there's a lot of room for exploration there.
Yeah, I mean, I think another thing that we're probably likely to at some point do more with in the in Orv would be the Munavri, which are the non-evil Darklands race that are descended from Aslant, and they live on weird
jade ships,
islands in the middle of the Sightless Sea and stuff. So because they are a player character, a race that's intended to be for player characters, that's at least the vector that I think we're most likely to approach or from, just because more people can use it.
I know this might actually be answered in the playtest, but goblins are... How do goblins go from these horrible little creatures that blow up everything to player characters?
So,
like, I know that it was a fan thing, and I love it.
Yeah. So the question was, how do goblins go from being horrible little creatures into player characters? And
have you met a player character before?
So one thing to keep in mind is that... questions of the organized play aside, in which there are thousands of player characters all working together at the same time, in any one campaign setting, the player characters are the rarest things on that planet, because there's only four of them, or however many
six
are at your table.
Or,
six,
yeah.
However. And if one of those happens to be a goblin, that could be the only goblin on the planet that, in your version of Galarian or whatever, that is like that, is not a crazy maniac. There's still going to be crazy maniac goblins in second edition. In the same way that there have and always will be crazy maniac humans, elves, dwarves, gnomes, all of that. In second edition, we will have more stuff with goblins that aren't as crazy and maniacal. We're going to be working some storylines coming up that start giving goblins a chance to, in certain areas, a chance to, come out from under this sort of category.
And one thing to remember about goblins is that they tend to live to be only about 5 years old. And it's very hard for a society to progress. Like, they have no generational memory because the oldest member of their tribes are, like, 7 or 8. And so it's no wonder that even in, quote-unquote, civilized goblin areas, they they don't progress as a society, and they're still set in those chaotic ways. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps if given a chance and
I don't know, guided.
Yeah.
In a way that allowed them to see what happened with their society if they didn't all die at 5 years old, then maybe they could do other things.
Yeah. It's also going to be something that the playtest will tell us. The playtest isn't out yet. I mean, people have seen bits and pieces that we've leaked out through blogs and stuff like that. But until the playtest rules are actually out at Gen Con and people have had a chance to like start playing through Doomsday Dawn and start looking at how it all comes together, we're sort of in a holding pattern. So if it turns out that people really do prefer goblins to be, you know, more of a tool for GMs, that's not off the table. We might take them out of the game and put them into a later book or something like that if people really, really love playing goblins. And we've already had multiple adventures in which you play goblins, and they've been really popular. I've had people on the boards talk about how they ran Rise of the Rune Lords with goblin characters, and it's a lot of fun. And it's also
finished it.
I don't. If you have fun, I don't care if you finish it. But so it's something that that's definitely something we're going to be looking at. The playtest is not just do hit points work, does attack roll math work. The playtest is really does the game work as a whole, and that's math, that's flavor, do you like the way that we're laying the book out. So we're going to be listening long and hard to everything that people say about goblins. So make sure you play test and make sure you let us know. That corner there. Yes, you.
All right. Why do true atheists repel Grotius?
Why do true atheists repel Grotius?
Got a snarky answer that'll get me yelled at online.
Oh, no.
You want to try to... I have a snarky answer as well. And so
do I. I mean, we are who we are, so...
So let me try to get my answer out. It was a mistake in the way that I was creatively directing that first adventure that talked about atheists. My intent for atheists are that they obviously should exist in the world because we want Galarian to be inclusive and have all sorts of different, you know, beliefs and everything like that. Some atheists repel Grotius. That's not all atheists. So in a world where the gods actually do exist and there is an actual afterlife for your soul to go to and be judged and have something happen, that still happens if you're an atheist or not. So just like when you are, if you're a worshiper of Serenray and you are a great worshiper of Serenray, you're going to go into the afterlife and be in High Mirania, Serenray's, no, that's Pazuzu, oops.
You're
going to, same person. You're going to be, you know, go to Nirvana and be comfortable and enjoy a happy afterlife. If you were a bad Serenray, and you might end up going to hell and be tormented all life. The same thing basically happens for atheists. If you are a bad atheist, and that doesn't mean that you are bad at your religion. If you just, your soul is a failed soul for whatever reason, the pharasma judges you are failed or not. In that case, you will go into a punishment in your afterlife, which is the same for everything else. If you are an atheist who did not fail, then you will ascend on to one of the main things that I like doing is either you will get reincarnated and put back into the cycle, or you'll become like a free-floating soul that is set loose to wander the existence and just experience and explore and learn more and like gather information or something like that. So in the early days of Pathfinder, we didn't really have a good way to answer that, and it ended up coming out in a module, Beyond the Vault of Souls, I think, mm-hmm. Which was not something that was under my purview at that point, because we didn't have a creative director at that time, and it kind of went out. It didn't get fully looked over. The implications kind of went into print before they should have. So that's basically my stance on it. And I did what I could to clear that up in Planar Adventures.
Thank you.
Yeah. I don't know if that covers the snarkiness or you know.
No, I hate
it. It'll just make the snarkiness look like pettiness, so I'm not gonna I'm not gonna say it.
That's another thing too, is there's a lot of stuff we really enjoy creating the game. We have ideas on what we like and what we think would be fun for a game, but that's not necessarily going to be fun for anyone else's game, and it's something that increasingly I know I've been trying to keep an eye on and make sure that what is in the game is something that is useful for everybody. And at the same point, let people know that you don't have to put something in your game just because we put it in a book. You know your players more than we do. We don't know who your players are. You're the ones that are in charge of deciding what is appropriate for your table. You need to know what your players want, what your players' preferences are, and the game should be fun. And if what we publish isn't fun for your table, you should absolutely not use what we publish, I guess is what I'm trying to say. I don't know if that was too serious.
Maybe. Nah. Okay. We'll fix that here soon.
Yeah. All right. Another question there in the middle. Yeah.
The Shaylin Zong Kuthon arc, does that ever come to an end? And if so, will you share what that ending is?
The question is the Shaylin and Zong Kuthon arc, whether it'll come to an end and how it started. Well, it started, they were brother and sister.
Yeah.
That's.
And then
Zong Kuthon had a problem.
Well, Dubral had a.
Dubral.
Yeah.
Had a problem. Yeah.
Changed his name. He's kind of going through a phase.
There's, again, Planar Adventures has, one of the elements of Planar Adventures is it talks a lot about the deities and their relationships with each other and where they live and who they are. Whereas Intersea Gods really focused hard on the worshippers of the gods and what it's like to be a priest of a deity and all that. Planar Adventures does go into a bit more detail about that. Where the story is going, I'm not sure yet, but that could be something that we do. I could see it be a adventure path in the future where Shellen decides that it's time to force her brother to recant, or Zong Kuthon decides it's time to get revenge on his sister or something like that.
He probably wants his glaive back.
Yeah. So however we tackle it is, I mean, that's one of the things that's really interesting about our gods is they're not perfect. They make mistakes. And whether it's Shellen making the mistake or Zong Kuthon making the mistake is an entirely different adventure path, and that's not something we've really put much thought into yet.
But we do internally know what happened to Dubral that made him change into Zong Kuthon.
Yeah.
We don't yet know what the implications of that are, but when we reveal that, it'll be the major focus of a story that we're telling, because it's got implications that are far reaching, and to just put it in as a single paragraph in a book about even Nadal.
There's hints about it in the Nadal book. There's hints about it in Book of the Damned. There's hints about it in Planar Adventures.
Yeah.
So
once we do reveal it, everyone will be like, oh yeah, that thing they said years ago. Hopefully, they'll recognize all the hints that we've left. So
check. All right, if you want to know where exactly, so this is a little homework. Check the final paragraph in the section that's talking about the abyss, where it talks about beyond the beyond.
In what book?
Book of the Damned. So, all right. I guess rather than make everybody run to the internet, it implies that Zong Kuthon traveled beyond the great beyond. The inner sphere is basically. This all the inner planes. The outer sphere is all of the outer planes, like hell and Abaddon and all that. There's a question about what is beyond that, and that may
what is the outer sphere inside?
Yeah, and Zong Kuthon Dubral may have encountered something out there beyond reality, which is, I think, something we've said in print. It's squirreled away. It's pretty subtle. It's not Lovecraft stuff. Somebody who hasn't asked a question yet. They're in the red shirt.
How about the Star Stone and how it makes gods out of mortals? How about that big mystery?
That would be a pretty cool adventure, don't you think?
Yeah.
There's in the Adventure Path seminar we just did, there are certain stories that are really, really good stories you can tell in the Adventure Path format over six parts, or even in Starfinder's case, over three parts. There are other adventures that really work well, stories that really work well, standalone adventures. And I've always felt that the Starstone and the Test of the Starstone works best as a standalone adventure.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be gobsmacked if we don't do that someday. I just don't know when we're going to do it. Should we do an adventure like that?
Yes!
20th level mythic module.
It's not going to be 20th level mythic.
Aww.
Starters, we won't have mythic.
Yeah,
if you're 20th level mythic, you're kind of a god already. You don't need to go to the Starstone.
Yeah.
We got time. What do we got here? Oh, we got plenty of time. We got lots more questions. Yeah, this is going pretty well. All right, let's go right here.
I guess just probably to feed conjecture, really. Out of the published venture captains, how many of them are members of the 10?
10. The question was out of the published venture captains, how many of them are members of the 10? I think that answer is going to be central to the upcoming season of Pathfinder Society Year of the 10. I have not been as involved.
Right.
Yeah, I haven't been as involved in the planning of that as I was past seasons. But my understanding is that part of the goal is to reveal the identities of at least some of the Decemberate.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, so, yeah, you'll definitely want to check that out. I don't want to say too much more because, you know, we might give the wrong information.
Yeah, no,
like
yeah, none of us
it's
work
pretty
directly
cool
on
they
those
got
products.
Names. I'm
yeah.
there, back there.
How many Pathfinder characters were sort of in their lives out as employees?
Yeah, James.
How many Pathfinder NPCs started out as employee PCs?
Yes, James. Oh. Tell us, James.
All right. Do they have to be PCs, or do they? So there's some that are PCs. There's some that are player characters that have become non-player characters with stat blocks. And there's some that are player characters that have not yet become characters with stat blocks, but are iconic prestige classes.
The answer is lots and lots of them.
Yeah. I think Jensen, Amiko, and Bezalaru, the iconic demonologist in Book of the Damned, are three of my characters. I don't know if you've got your corgis in there. That's not a player character, though.
No, she's not a player character, but my corgis...
Why are corgis not a player character, Race?
Don't ask me, ask the creative director. James?
They don't have thumbs. They can't use...
Hand.
Yet neither do halflings after they escape Cheliax. What are you saying?
So maybe you're saying halflings and corgis are the same thing?
It's just like in Castle Freak. Yeah.
Oh, that's a good movie.
Yeah. You can play Walruses in
Starfinder. Yeah, exactly.
That's true.
Yeah. I think that we to answer the question seriously, I mean, I think that there are a lot, and that's one of the advantages of being a freelancer or a member of the staff is that when there's a gap of a character, you can go to your own home games as an inspiration for who that character is going to be. And so there are probably some that we don't even know about that our freelancers have put in games, you know, that we just thought, hey, that's a cool character. And little do we know that they played that character when they were in high school or something.
Yeah, the one I've gotten to drop in is Martella from War for the Crown. But, like, the original player character version and what Thirsty wrote her as are so very, very different that...
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, the version of Amiko that I played in an old Planescape adventure was a master spy who had a kobold samurai as a traveling companion. So that's pretty different.
Or is it?
Oh, no, there's another one, Chuko, I put in.
You did
Chuko the Tengu.
Oh, God, that's right.
I
put one of my Tengu in.
Yeah, so we're Tengu team. Team Tengu. So plenty.
Yeah, so we all do it, and I can't even remember which of my characters I put in, you know, because it was a long time ago. So it's
Yeah, that's right. Corvadro Fushi showed up in Hell's Rebels.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. All right.
And of course, everybody kept her alive to add to your team, right?
Because
she's
the
awesome.
Best.
And not statted.
She's statted.
Her sisters, I think, are just standard Tengu staff blocks.
Oh,
yes, but
her.
All right, right there.
So you have a lot of big secrets that have been around for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any new big secrets planned with second edition?
Ooh.
That would be long-running, not answered for a long time, but people will speculate.
Yeah,
yeah. The question was that we have a lot of at least 10-year-old secrets that we haven't answered and whether or not there would be new ones going forward. And I think, like James said before, when we answer a question, we want to ask at least one more to fill its place, if not two. Because once we stop having those secrets and stop having mysteries in the setting, then we're done. Then that's it. There's no reason for us to keep publishing stuff.
Was it second edition where we're going to introduce the go-kart lords?
No.
Of Goka?
Yeah, for
go-kart, go-karts of Goka.
For the iconic racing minigame.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. With sure. The banana peel magic item.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, we are making changes to the campaign setting. You know, our final first edition adventure path is all about the Whispering Tyrant. So that's going to affect the status quo and the face of the Inner Sea region as we've known it for the last 10 years. And along with those changes and updating of the setting will come new seeds that we plant for ourselves to pick up later.
Or whoever comes after
us. Or whoever comes after us, yeah.
Like Doomsday Dawn takes the Octurna Enigma and basically brings that story to a close. And there's no more really to tell after that adventure is done. It's doing what it does.
Yeah.
And I made sure to include at least one new mysterious character, the Ashen Man, who shows up, and he's pretty spooky, creepy, is up to something, and so that you get one storyline closed off, but another one may start up.
And then, yeah, so then going forward, people may be asking us in these seminars in a year or two, what's the Ashen Man up to, what's his deal?
Mm-hmm.
And we'll say,
Stay tuned, wait
and find out, yeah.
Let's see, back there in the back. Yes.
Now, in some of the material that's come out over the years, you've detailed a lot of, I guess you'd call them, mega dungeons and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, only two of them, or one of them, I guess, with the Whispering Tyrant Spire, have played a major part in the history of Galarian, sort of as we've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
What role are these sort of complexes going to play going forward, if any?
I think probably a stronger one. A mega dungeon is a perfect example of something that doesn't really work well in an adventure path format. We tried that with Shattered Star, mm-hmm. and it wasn't a mega dungeon. It was six big dungeons, but they were all separated by location and all that. Whereas a single adventure that's 120 pages or 320 pages or whatever big it needs to be. Is the right way to do a mega dungeon. And since we haven't really traditionally had a format that allows us to do giant adventures like that, we just haven't done many with them. And that's something that I'm hoping that second edition will allow us to do. So I guess the question is, what will the role of the mega dungeon be in second edition? And I guess the answer, I would hope to be a bigger role.
We certainly, I think, have some stories that we're planning to
yeah.
tell very early in second edition that would lend themselves very well to
yeah.
either be set in or supported by an adventure in a mega dungeon.
I've always, the one that I would like to do the most is the Crimson Citadel, which is the headquarters of the Red Mantis.
Yes!
And I know Eric Mona wants to someday publish a Spire of Next adventure.
Yeah.
I mean,
sure.
So, yeah.
But any day now.
But again, those things are, in those two specific cases, Eric and I are, we're busy doing other stuff too, so whether or not we do those or we have somebody else write one of them,
Go for it, Mark.
Oh, yeah, I'm not busy at all. Yeah, that sounds great.
You just play with your minis.
Play video games all day.
Yeah.
Someone has to make sure that all million lines of dialogue in Kingmaker are accurate to our setting.
Oh, man. Turns out it's not. It's just work.
It's work, yes.
Yes,
small secrets. What's a personal favorite little Galarian Easter egg that each of you have?
Mark shall answer that first.
Okay, the question was, what is a secret Galarian Easter egg that we each like?
Does it have to be one that nobody's noticed yet?
It doesn't have to be, no.
Okay.
If you like it and it's an Easter egg, go for it.
They're all going to say
it's,
stuff that, no, that everyone's noticed.
So. Yeah, it's tough because I tend to try not to do Easter eggs. Any that I've put in to this campaign setting have been ones that were to other aspects of the campaign setting, as opposed to references to outside things. Yeah, I can't. There's not one that really comes to mind.
There's,
now, I think of the internally consistent Easter eggs as us doing our job of making the setting one cohesive thing. And any time that we're putting a reference to Doctor Who or, you know, Star Wars or whatever in there, that's us not doing our job.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I don't know, one random one, I guess, is Barzilai Throne, the main bad guy from Hell's Rebels, looks the way he does because I wanted a bad guy that symbolized how frustrated and annoyed and bored I was with every video game being a white guy with a close-cut cropped hair or space marine look. So, I mean, ever since Doom came out, it seems like every video game character is that same person. I was like, I just want to have the player characters beat that guy up. So.
That's great.
Man, I put my wife in a lot of things. So she shows up as an NPC in a lot of adventures and a lot of books I've written.
And as a town.
Yeah,
yeah.
There's a little town mentioned in Iron Fang Invasion. We just needed a bunch of towns for Malthoon because...
Yeah.
It's a very underdeveloped area, so one of them is the town of Gillet. Her last name is Gie.
Yeah.
Yay.
So I just took out the U and stopped, or didn't use the French pronunciation.
Yeah, and so some of the things I've done names. I've named NPCs after, you know, friends, kids, or, you know, just like take a name and you rearrange the letters a little bit so it's slightly different. Those are the types of stuff that I've put in there. And yeah, I can't remember a specific one
now,
but that's how I do a lot of naming.
I guess
my
favorite one, now that I think about it a little more, is Sandpoint, because that's basic. It's based pretty hardcore on my hometown of Point Arena, and a lot more of Sandpoint is from the real world than I think anybody.
And what is
suspect.
Point Arena translated to English?
It's Point Arena translated to English is Sandpoint. So, Point Arena. So,
yeah.
When the town was founded, they had a sign outside of town with a mirror on it saying, please check yourself out and see you as we see you, or something along those lines. There's an old lighthouse. There's a Japanese ship sailed across the Pacific Ocean and landed in Point Arena. So that's why Amico is a big part of Sandpoint. There's a big movie theater in the middle of town that shouldn't be able to support a big movie theater. And so there's all sorts of stuff like that in Point Arena that that I stuck into Sandpoint. And then the Sandpoint Devil is an invader, but he's pretty cool.
An invader?
Yeah, he's from... That's the Jersey Devil.
Oh, okay.
So that's Wes getting into my town. But in a good way. What else we got?
We got about
see if we can get somebody who hasn't asked a question yet. Spread it around. All right.
Well, I've had my hand raised for a while, and going through multiple questions in my head.
Okay.
I'm going to go with... this is a god that I just randomly found out of nowhere, and I've fallen in love with, but there's next to nothing about him. What are you guys planning on doing with Ragathiel?
Oh, Ragathiel? The Imperial Lord?
Yeah.
We've done a
General Vengeance.
We've done quite a lot of it. I mean, he's one of the few we've actually statted up.
Yes,
he shows
up
in... Bestiary 6?
Bestiary 5?
Yeah, he's also got a page in...
Chronicle of the Righteous.
Yeah, and if I recall, we did a Ragathiel-themed... location in
the Heaven Book.
Heaven Unleashed.
Heaven Unleashed, yeah.
If I recall, and I developed that a long time ago, so I've
covered a lot more than most of our Imperial
Lords. As far as the Imperial Lords go, we've done quite a bit with Ragathiel. I think that because he presents a moral quandary that encapsulates one that people actually bring up all the time on our message boards is about whether or not a paladin can smite evil and still be good. You know, and so Ragathiel really is that, like...
It's a personification.
Yeah,
of that.
Personification of that. It's our way of exploring the implications of being a holy warrior who is really just out for vengeance and mm-hmm. destruction. But as long as it's just of the evil things, then that's okay, right? So it's certainly area ripe for us to do more with.
And we probably will, because people are these one of the Imperial Lords that people seem to be pretty intrigued by. So
yeah, he's one that most people can recognize by name, which is more than a lot of Imperial Lords can.
Sorry about that. That being said, are you guys ever going to publish like other than the original campaign? Are you guys ever going to publish like an eventual pronunciation guide for all the gods and demigods and all that stuff? Because holy crap,
we could. The problem is that if we were to do a pronunciation guide for all of the made up words that we make, it'd be really big. It would take up a lot of room. We could, I guess, do something like online or something like that at some
maybe.
Point.
I mean, it would be a lot of work for us to do, and the usefulness to the community is. I think our effort would probably be better spent.
Yeah.
Doing a whole new adventure instead of telling you how to pronounce something. I mean,
if you see a name, particularly if it's a monster or a deity or a demigod or something, first check you should do is go to Google and Google it up, because a lot of these things we take from mythology and the real words. Like Regathiel is
an actual real angel from mythology. And you can always just ask us specific ones on the message boards.
Yeah, right here.
I mean, it's something that I've dealt with quite a bit with our licensees, actually, because we have, you know, audiobooks and we have voiceover for the Kingmaker game. And they'll ask, hey, how do we pronounce this? And we have disagreements even within the office about how certain things are pronounced. Yeah. And so...
Theresia.
Yes.
Yeah, that's creepy.
The one thing that is just not up for debate is how D-R-O-W is pronounced.
It rhymes with the word B-O-W.
Yes. Okay, next question.
What?
Yeah, we got time for probably one more. Somebody that... right there, the red shirt.
One of the NPCs who I saw pretty early on, who I was like, oh, this guy seems really interesting, is Osprey. And nothing's been done with him in a while, it seems.
Yeah. From Pathfinder Society? Didn't he stop being a venture captain?
Well, Osprey...
Or he never was.
Yeah, so the question was about Osprey, who was a Pathfinder Society NPC. He was really a pet character of Tim Hitchcock, who invented him, and if you notice everywhere that Osprey appeared, it was always in a scenario that Tim wrote.
I used him in one of mine.
Yeah, he appears a few other places, but... the last time we really used him was in the Moonscar adventure, in which he had been, spoiler, kidnapped by demons on the moon. And so I think the...
This is just word salad at this point.
Yes.
Exactly.
At least the canonical assumption that I've been operating under, I don't know whether it's true for the organized play team, is that he's still on the moon until that adventure takes place, which is why he hasn't been around. So when we codify the results of our first edition adventures as we move into second edition, we will likely be revisiting that and say, what's the status of the moon scar and the demons and prisoners there at the start of second edition. So he may still come back and do stuff.
But again, if Nocticula becomes non-evil, that whole thing might blow up.
Who knows what'll happen if Nocticula becomes non-evil. Good thing she won't. And I think that's...
Yeah, I think we're probably out of time.
Yeah,
553. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for joining us for another PaizoCon 2018 seminar recording. Special thanks to the KD Con team, including Justin Sluder, Ryan Hiller, Stephen Glicker, and the entire Roll for Combat crew. No Direction's PaizoCon coverage would not be possible without their tireless effort. To find this and other great Pathfinder podcasts, visit nodirectionpodcast.com.